Every day, we rise, challenging ourselves to work for what we believe in. At U.S. Border Patrol, protecting our borders is more than a job. It's a calling. Agents answer the call, working together to keep our country and communities safe. If you are ready for a new mission, join U.S. Border Patrol and go beyond. Learn more at cbp.gov/careers.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This episode is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Sharealike 4.0 international license. For more information, visit creativecommons.org.
Somebody stole our website.
Oh no, whatever shall we do?
I mean, I guess you could go to the new website, http://breakingmathpodcast.app, with no www for all you old timers.
So breakingmathpodcast.app? I mean, if you're into that sort of thing.
Hey, Breaking Math fans. First, I want to thank you for listening. I have an important message for everyone. You can start your own podcast right now with Anchor. Anchor lets you create and distribute your own podcast. Just get an idea, record, and upload. It's just that easy. Anyone can do it. I'm on my way to accomplishing my dream, and you can too. Just get on your device's app store and download Anchor. It contains everything you need to make a podcast. With Anchor, you can put your podcast on all the big platforms. Apple Podcast, Spotify, Google Podcast, Amazon, and more. Reach the whole world with Anchor. Best of all, Anchor is free. You have nothing to lose with a free platform. Download the Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started.
Information theory was founded in 1948 by Claude Shannon and is a way of both qualitatively and quantitatively describing the limits and processes involved in communication. Roughly speaking, when two entities communicate, they have a message, a medium, some confusion, encoding, and decoding. And when two entities communicate, they transfer information between them. The amount of information that is possible to be transmitted can be increased or decreased by manipulating any of the aforementioned variables. One of the practical and original applications of information theory is to models of language itself. So what is entropy? How can we say language has it? And what structures within language with respect to information theory reveal deep insights about the nature of language itself? All this and more on this episode of Breaking Math. Episode 24, Language and Entropy. I'm Jonathan.
And I'm Gabriel.
And you're listening to Breaking Math. Just real quick, you could check out our website at breakingmathpodcast.com. You can find us on Gmail at breakingmathpodcast@gmail.com, breakingmathpod on Twitter. On Facebook, we could be found at facebook.com/breakingmathpodcast. And if you'd like, you could buy us a sandwich at patreon.com/breakingmathpodcast. So today we have on...
Tyler Jordan.
Tyler, why are you on today?
We're discussing information theory, and I've been on a couple times before, and as an electrical engineer who... works on communication systems, information theory is very important to what I do.
You've mentioned this before, but for our new listeners, your master's degree was from Stanford. And now, of course, as you had mentioned, it was electrical engineering with a focus on communications.
Yes, that's correct. And my undergrad was in electromagnetics. So it's kind of the medium in which a lot of information is transmitted.
Yeah, so Shannon's information theory is quite a relevant topic, huge, huge topic. It's one of my favorites, personally. In fact, one of our first three episodes was specifically on information theory. Episode 3, TMI, or Too Much Information, was recorded almost a year ago this date.
Yeah, and we're kind of going to come back to a lot of old concepts on this new season of Breaking Math. And one thing about this episode is we've done interview episodes before, and we've done traditional episodes, and it's going to be sort of a hybrid episode today. We're going to be talking with Tyler for the first roughly half of the episode about information theory itself. And then we're going to go into a couple of papers that we found that really espouse the concepts that we intend to communicate to you.
In this case, these papers, we chose these papers on purpose because they combine several topics. They combine language. We have an old episode all about language. They also talk about evolution, which is another episode of ours, and it involves, of course, information theory. So it kind of brings it all together in a really cool way. And in this case, it's taking concepts that are used typically in electronic communication and using them to describe language, which is, you know, of course, how humans can communicate, more or less.
Tyler, as a cross-disciplinary thing, what experience do you have as far as like either what your job goes or what your passions are with respect to language?
To language?
Yeah, and especially as far as information theory goes. Like, do you just appreciate it for its demonstrative value in things like information theory itself in like the original paper, or do you use it as a way of sort of like couching the concepts for your own mind?
Yeah, it's really nice to be able to study something, you know, that pertains to my job and my education. I studied information theory and then realize just how much it can be related to language. And when we talk about electrical engineer communication systems, it's a lot more simple than how humans actually communicate. There's a lot more simple rules, and that's why we can do this math and very much characterize how we're transmitting information through electronic communications. But it's neat to see, though it's simpler to apply the math to this electrical stuff, you can say, oh wow, I actually see this concept come up in language. And this language that I, you know, innately have been born with the capacity to understand language, and then have learned language and understand how I understand language, that these concepts totally apply.
You know, one thing I want to add to that is, as I've learned more and more about how mathematics are used to model phenomena in the universe, I simply love when one can take a concept in math and model language or any aspects in culture. Another fun fact we've mentioned on this podcast before is Breaking Math was originally called Math and Culture. I think Breaking Math is a cooler name personally, but I simply love the idea of acknowledging mathematics as the language of the universe, but then being able ultimately to describe all aspects of culture. Maybe someday we'll even go into the mathematics of law and more concepts of philosophy and how those can be modeled and described with mathematics and entropy and things like that.
Yeah, and speaking of which, I was talking to a speech-language pathologist, and she asked what I was doing this podcast on. I said information theory. And I started explaining it to her, and she said, oh my gosh, that's exactly what I do in my job. Though she doesn't deal with these mathematics to, you know, incredibly describe in detail what to do, she works on the same exact thing with people who have problems communicating, who need to recover communication skills, who maybe can't hear in certain frequency ranges or can't speak with certain things, or they use sign language. She works with them to be able to communicate with error correction coding, things like this, without knowing information theory, in quotes. She actually takes her patients through the same kind of methods we're going to talk through in electronic information theory.
And I think that shows the success of the theory itself. It reminds me a lot of Newton's laws and what a baseball player might do. A baseball player is using a lot of Newton's laws, I mean all of them basically, when they're doing what they do. And it's a successful theory because it describes what they you know, are experiencing. And that's one of the important things about math, is that math reflects reality or creates reality in some cases.
Yeah, I'd like to mention that just as we were researching this episode, so many things occurred to me. We can talk about not only spoken language, but we can also talk about, as Tyler said earlier, sign language. But I'm going to even bring it further. We can also talk about information theory and entropy and things like DNA. There's just so many applications. This is just an awesome, awesome, fertile field.
On today's podcast, we're going to talk about information theory. And we're going to recap a little bit of that with Tyler. And we're going to talk about a paper after that.
The paper we're going to talk about is called Language Evolution and Information Theory by Joshua B. Plotkin and Martin A. Nowak.
So when I started a new semester at Stanford, I came home to my roommate, and he's an aerospace engineer, and he said, oh, what classes are you taking? You know, I'm taking aircraft design, very, you know, concrete. I know what that's about. I said, oh, well, I'm taking information theory. And he said, what does that even mean? That literally means nothing to me. Information theory? That's like theory, like information. What are you talking about? So I thought that was really, really kind of a funny funny thing, because it doesn't really mean much until you really define what we're talking about. So let's define it. Information is what is conveyed or represented in a particular arrangement or sequence of things. So you can think about this in terms of words. You know, I'm speaking this sentence, and you're understanding information from it. Images can convey things. Symbols, you know, you can arrange rocks in a certain order, and you can convey information.
Now, what I noticed about your definition right there, first off the bat, and I know this is probably what a lot of people, especially not familiar with information theory, are thinking, is that a lot of the things seem to require the definition before. And maybe that's why it took until 1948 to discover. Because you say convey, but how can you have the concept of conveyance without information? It seems almost too basic to have a theory made out of it.
Exactly. I mean, you can say communication. What is that? It's transmitting information. You know, and so we're saying, but information theory is studying how we communicate information. But yes, it does contain itself. But it's basically the study of the effective or efficient ways of transmitting information.
Now, what motivated this discovery?
Well, back in the day, they were running a bunch of telephone lines to different customers, and they wanted, you know, the business is business, and they want to bring this this service at a lower cost to their customers so they can compete and they can make more money. And so they started looking at, okay, we have this much telephone line. How many people can talk on the same telephone line at the same time?
Yeah, and of course, telephone lines being made out of a very expensive metal, if you have that much of it, copper, makes sense for the motivation.
Yeah, so they started studying, well, can two people talk over the same telephone line at the same time? And there are ways you can do that, and there are studies of how to do that. And Shannon, we'll get to Shannon's information theory a little bit later. But like we said, in 1948, he was one of the basically the founder of information theory, and wrote this equation that is still used today, 80 years later. So how do you measure the amount of information? It's the number of pages in that book, or, you know, if you have a binary string, ones and zeros, you just say, okay, this file is 100 kilobytes, so it has 100 kilobytes of information. That file is 100 gigabytes, so it has 100 gigabytes of information.
Now, as I recall, one of the principles of information theory, just to get the mathematical equations down, was a really simple concept. He said I don't remember how he phrased it in the paper, but it was something to the effect of, if you have two pages, you have twice the possible amount of information representable as if you had one page, which seems very elemental, and that's probably why it was so powerful. I mean, we've talked on this podcast, even last episode, about the power of axioms and assumptions.
That's exactly right. And when we get to Shannon's capacity theorem, we see that doubling the pages is doubling the bandwidth. And so you can double your capacity. And we'll get to that a little bit later. So when we're talking about information, you know, I said 100 kilobytes versus 100 gigabytes. Well, it's like we could think, okay, so the bigger the book, the more information can have. But that's not necessarily true. I mean, which has more information? 10 books of blank pages or one pamphlet? So it turns out that the more predictable the transmission, that is, there's 100 blank pages, that's pretty predictable, versus a pamphlet that will be, you know, changing words on every, you know, changing letters on every word. So the more predictable the transmission is, the less information it holds.
Now, this means that it's, in a sense, an applied statistical model. And I know I had problems with accepting statistics as a genuine branch of mathematics when I was younger, just because, I mean, when you're taught statistics, you're taught heuristics half the time. You're not really taught the essence of statistics. So how would you defend this as a mathematical theory? to those people.
So it gets confusing, and this is what I had a bunch of trouble with. So this is a problem I had when studying probabilistic methods or stochastic signal processing, as you go, well, math is so definite. It defines, this is exactly the number we have. So when we say, this random value can take any value between 0 and 1, how is that deterministic? How is that an actual thing we can study in mathematics and be certain of? And the way it is that we say, okay, we're not studying what that number actually ends up being, but we're studying the bounds of that number. We know it has to be between 0 and 1. It is more likely to take the value 0.5 than 0.75. And we can say how much more likely it is that it takes the value of 0.5 than 0.75. Things like that. And so we actually do have solid numbers, solid logic that that characterizes random processes.
Now, the logic that characterizes these random processes, I think you described it very well there. And just one thing I had to add was the fact that probability itself can be defined in terms of what's called measure theory, which maybe we'll do an episode on one of these days, where measure theory, basically using this very rigorous form of mathematics, you can derive basic statistics. What's the first concept in information theory which you'd like to discuss?
Yes, so it's the amount of information versus the length of your communication. So like I said, let's say you have 10 books with blank pages and one word. It says nachos on the last page. And then you have a pamphlet that talks all about nachos, and it's only 2 pages long. Well, one of them is way longer than the other. The books, that's way longer of a transmission. But it conveys so much less information.
These pamphlets do have less inherent capacity. Like, if we could change the words around, like, you're not saying that they do have less information always just because they're pamphlets, right? I mean, that almost goes without saying.
Correct. So the capacity of the 10 books is far larger than the capacity of the pamphlet. However, the way you're transmitting the information that you did transmit is far less than in the books than you transmitted in the pamphlets.
Are estimates of information theory absolute, or are they just estimates, and how accurate are they?
Yeah, and so in terms of digital communication, when we can, you know, very much characterize the, you know, this kind of information, we can come up with, you know, mathematical certainty. Yes, I'm transmitting more information in this pamphlet than you did in your books. Now, when it comes to language, it can be more subjective. Every one of us has read a book that the author repeats the same idea 10 times in 10 slightly different ways that could be summed up in one way. So they didn't transmit all that much information. But it's a little subjective, right? Because we kind of are the judges of that. But, you know, when we talk about digital communications, everything, we define it. We have defined everything about the channel, everything about the information, so we can actually come up with numbers that say, hey, this is a less efficient form of communication than this other one. We measure this randomness with a property called entropy. And this is kind of a fun thing because entropy is extensible to all sorts of physics and mathematics. But we can also say, entropy is the lack of order or predictability. And in information theory, it is defined as the logarithmic measure of the transfer rate of information in a particular message or language.
And why is it that Shannon Joe is logarithmic?
That is the nature of the transmission itself.
Why is that the nature of information? Does it have to do with, for example, capacity, or does it have to do...
It does have to do with the capacity of a channel and the distance between words in a lexicon.
So I think what I'm getting at is somebody might take a look at what you're saying, like, okay, like one page can store a kilobyte, 2 page can possibly store 2 kilobytes, mm-hmm. and see that it's very linear. But I think they might fail to see the combinatoric aspect that requires the logarithmic component. So for our listeners who maybe are in eighth grade and don't know much about logarithms, how would you break that down for them?
Logarithms is basically just looking at the exponent. So if you have 2 squared or 3 squared or 3 to the x, something like that, where logarithms just look at that exponent, essentially.
Yeah, they kind of count digits in a number.
So if you think about it, if you have a bit string, okay, this is just basically ones and zeros followed by one another. We could say, you know, 0, okay, then the next one could be a 0 or a 1. So the probability that it is a 1 is 2, because there's only 2 possible characters we have. It's a 0 or a 1. So it's 2 to the 1 power. We can either choose one of two things, okay? When you add another one to it, you have to say, okay, first we had to choose between 0 and 1, and then we had to choose between 0 and 1 again. So it's combinatorics. You have to multiply it by another 2. So now instead of 2 choices, it's 2 times 2 choices. And we add another one, now it's 2 times 2 times 2 choices. Okay, so now we have 2 to the third choices for this bit string. So, you know, we can keep thinking about it in terms linearly, okay, 2 to the third, okay, 2 to the fourth, or we could look at it logarithmically and say, okay, for every bit we add, it's the probability that we end up on a certain bit string is 2 to the n, where n is the number of bits in that string. And so now when we look at it logarithmically, now we can say, okay, logarithmically it's n.
Yeah, I think a way to kind of solidify that in the minds of some listeners is that if we assigned a number to every word in English and just kind of strung these numbers together, we'd get a gigantic number. But if you count the number of digits in that number, it would correspond to the number of letters, roughly, in that book. So if we had, like, this page being translated to a 2,000-digit number, we'd know that it had, for example, something like 500 characters because of the properties of logarithms.
Yes. So this entropy, well, there's a mathematic definition. The sum of all probabilities times the log of the inverse of that probability. What happens there is when you, you know, you have two choices. Let's say we're flipping a coin, and this coin has equal probability of landing on heads and tails. So you'd say, okay, what is the entropy of this coin toss? So you'd say 0.5 times log of 1 over 0.5 plus 0.5 times log 1 over 0.5. And so from that, you do the math and you get 1. Okay, so our entropy is 1. It's a perfectly random system, this coin toss. Now let's say you have a coin that has a 75% chance of landing on heads and a 25% chance of landing on tails. Physically impossible. We can come up with a coin that's kind of rounded on one side that would give us this kind of thing. But we go 75% times the log, and all these logarithms are log base 2. 75% times the log of 1 over 75% plus 25% times the log of 1 over 25%. When we do this, our entropy ends up 0.8. So our system is less random because we know you're going to get heads more than tails. We know that because that coin is it's a weighted coin, or however we want to say.
So it sounds like you're saying that there's less entropy the more you know about a system.
Correct. And just to take this to the edge here, you know, you have Harvey Dent's, you know, silver dollar that has heads on each side. Okay, so it's, then we'd have 0 times log of 1 over 0 and plus, and this, you can take the limit of this, plus 1 times log of 1 over 1, and you get 0 plus 0, which is 0. So the entropy of Harvey Dent's coin is 0. There is no randomness in a coin that has heads on both sides.
And that's for an obvious reason, because there's no randomness in perfect predictability.
Exactly. It's perfectly predictable what that coin is going to land on.
So if I had a coin that it landed on heads and then tails, but it was guaranteed to always land on tails after it landed on heads and vice versa, would that also have zero entropy?
Yes, because after that first coin toss, we say it landed on heads. And if you kept track of that, you know with 100% predictability that the next toss is going to land on tails.
And so how does that relate to what are known as Markov chains?
Well, what you described there is a Markov chain of, I want to say, length 2, because I remembered the last coin toss, and I'm going to make my next prediction off of what I observed last time. But if I had a Markov chain of 1, which is just one system, each time it's like my memory is wiped. You know, you told, you know, maybe, you know, in the beginning, hey, every other one is going to be heads. But if I don't know that, if I get my memory wiped between each one, it's like every time's the first time, every time's the new time. And so when you flip the coin, I have no idea what it's going to land on. So the Markov chain of one, it's still totally random. With the Markov chain of two, when you tell me, hey, it's going to be opposite every time, the first time is totally random, but then every time after that, I know exactly what that coin's going to land on.
We are going to talk about a paper that takes those very concepts in Shannon's information theory and uses them to talk about the evolution of human language. So before we start, I'd like to go and introduce our guests. Of course, we've got...
Hello, I'm Monica Harms. Well, I am a speech-language pathologist, and I work at the School for the Deaf in Santa Fe, and I thought this paper was really interesting because it talked about language. Language evolution and information theory.
Yeah, this is a really exciting paper. I was really happy to find it because I think one of the things that Jonathan and I love to do is to find applications for the mathematics that we talk about, and with respect to the mathematics here, which is Shannon's information theory, obviously it's used to talk about communication devices, but not only communication devices and cables, but actual language itself. That's pretty cool.
And one thing that we have here is something that you see very often in actually engineering, and not so much in pure math, and that's what makes this paper very interesting. It makes assumptions that may or may not be well-founded, that in order to devise a model for the evolution of language itself. What we're going to be talking about today is the appropriateness of the model laid out in the paper, how that model can be applied to practical research in linguistics, and what we're going to do in the future along the same lines of research.
Quick tangent here. So occasionally there may be a little squeak in the background. My darling son is here with us, and we may or may not edit that out, obviously, but it's cute. I think it's cute. So occasionally he may be joining us.
That's
our third guest. Yeah, our third guest. Yeah, he's still learning language. He's not at that point yet. So he just communicates through crying mostly, but he is learning language very fast.
Now, one interesting thing about the type of language that this child has, and I'm not going to say his name on air, mm-hmm. is that he uses what's called telegraphic communication, where everything has one meaning and context is nary to be found, really. And how that jumps from that model of language to a language where we could talk about language is a lot of the theme of this paper.
Yeah, so I guess the first thing we'll do is talk about impressions of the paper. Now, and again, it's worth mentioning that you have three people here who are, I guess, who use a lot of math in their schooling and in their, you know, work. And then as a speech language pathologist, I'm curious what kind of mathematics they had you do. Maybe statistics, is that right?
Yeah, a lot of statistics, yeah.
Okay.
Well, interestingly enough, we had spoken that you had done some frequency analysis, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of science behind speech mm-hmm. and how we produce sounds and looking at the acoustics and how well that's received and how well we can express ourselves. And that has to do with the science behind the vocal fold vibrations and that kind of thing. So,
because you said you were looking at spectrograms to look at people's speech patterns, right?
Yeah.
And for more information on spectrograms and frequency analysis, you could check out episode, I believe it's 18, but don't quote me on that, called Frequency.
Yep, that was the first episode that we had Tyler on, actually. It all relates. All mathematics comes together.
Yes.
Mathematics is a flat circle. If anybody's seen True Detective.
Okay. Oh, okay. No, I haven't.
So, Tyler, how did you relate to this paper as an electrical engineer, not necessarily as a person?
As an electrical engineer, you know, I could see, you know, I've studied a lot of how digital communication systems have worked, and these authors break down language. These authors break down language in terms of digital communication, that you have so many symbols that you can represent so many ideas with, and how that's translated. It was really pretty interesting to think of, not only think of language in a way of digital communications, but digital communications in a way of language.
May I add to that also as an electrical engineer? Whenever we're talking about the mathematics of anything, anything at all, you need to break things down to one concept. And I think it's safe to say that with respect to language, that's why it's so difficult. So you know, when I read this paper, and what I thought was pretty remarkable about this paper is how they create a model of language and they really, really boil it down. So basically, they have a model language proposed in this paper, and as you said, it was only three phonemes, right?
Yeah, and three words, right?
Yeah, and it's kind of a matter of combinatorics, and then obviously that is a far cry from any language that we recognize right now. You know,
also the way that it defines language is as the ability to refer to objects. And yes, you can qualify a process as an object, but I think that leaves an undue amount of combinatorics to the up to the imagination of the reader, which I think is one of the downfalls of this paper.
Yeah. I mean, defining language is hard to do.
Defining language can only be done with enough language, and we haven't reached that point.
But I think what's cool about it is that they did say, okay, let's take a starting place and analyze it. Mm-hmm. And the conclusions the authors come up with, some of them are very intuitive. And you say, yeah, mm-hmm. okay. So that kind of proves to yourself, oh, they're doing the math right, mm-hmm. if this is an intuitive answer. And then some of them are not so intuitive, and you can discover new things about language by mm-hmm. Realizing, you know, by looking at it in terms of a new framework, which is math, if it is a simplified mm-hmm. model of language. But that's what engineers do all the time, is we always mm-hmm. assume a simplified model.
Yeah. Yeah.
The only problem is with assuming spherical cows all over the place, though, is that you're gonna end up in a situation sooner or later where you ask yourself, if a spherical cow, how much does it weigh? 1,400 pounds. That's, I don't know, I assume that's how much cows weigh. And so you'd be like, great, we're coming to some rational conclusions. And it's like, what happens when you put a hot cow at the top of a hill? It's like, well, it rolls down. It's like, that's pretty unintuitive. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if the paper doesn't fall into that crevice. My intuition tells me that it doesn't.
Okay.
But because of all the math that they use, you can really paint yourself into the corner. And of course, I'm playing a little bit of devil's advocate here, but...
Yeah, and so I thought it was a great paper. It made me very curious about other aspects of language. So this just kind of dealt with phonemes and a few vocabulary words the phonemes that created those vocabulary words. But it made me think about word order and grammar and just different semantics and how some are more predictable than others. What, like, some word orders are... more efficient than others. And
that's actually quite interesting. As Jonathan was actually teaching me parts of computer science and, you know, part of the theory, there's some languages where the order of commands is completely different than the order that we speak in mm-hmm. normally. So made me think about that. And especially when you're talking about a concept like efficiency, that's real interesting.
And yeah, it's interesting too, is that most languages, and this is something that the paper also doesn't address, but it's something that you sort of brought up. Most languages tend to be subject, object, verb. Verb, subject, object, verb, object, subject. And before I just keep saying the words verb, object, subject in various orders, let me explain to you what that means.
After the next one. Yeah.
English is a subject, object, verb language, where you start with, it's not at all. It's a subject, verb, object.
Yeah. The girl kicked the ball.
Yeah, so the girl is the subject. Kicked is the verb. The ball is the object. But if it was a subject, object, verb, then it'd be the girl the ball kicked, which is dialectical Latin. Tends to follow that pattern.
Or Yoda.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think Yoda. Well, Yoda's speech patterns actually were borrowed from, I believe, Yiddish or Hebrew.
Hmm. Oh, wow. I had no idea.
But before we go off on way more of a tangent than we need to be, let's discuss a question I was actually going to have for you is how did the paper remind you of word order?
The fitness of a language, and basically how well is just errors that we can have. So somebody can say... pat, and you can think of it, you can mistake it for bat. But there's a lot of times where we mistake words as well. And, let me back up. Where when we're with like within a sentence, you can think of what that word is. If you didn't hear bat, you can use different strategies to figure that out. And it can be based on the word order. So like we were giving the example of we're talking about like I'm going to France, but somebody heard pants. Mm-hmm. And so kind of looking at, what would we have to do to correct for that error? And yeah, so it made me think of just all of the issues that we have in communication and how some sentences are more predictable than others. Like, pizza is my favorite. And if you didn't hear food, you would guess it's food. But if you say my favorite food is, it would be hard to guess pizza, you know? Yeah. So like one would be more predictable and easier to guess than another.
Hmm. So it reminds me of those songs, like, those songs that kids sing, like, Miss Daisy had a steamboat. The steamboat had a bell. Miss Daisy went to heaven. The steamboat went to hello, operator. Yeah. Things like that, which is you can actually model using Markov chains.
Yeah, and I think we also even touched on, you know, being able to solve or being able to predict. Obviously, you have to have prior knowledge to begin with. You know, you have to, so that's still a mathematical thing. We oftentimes talk about things like artificial intelligence and like what would really need to happen for a coherent language, you know, to emerge. And obviously, a big part of it is a prior bank of expected things that, you mm-hmm. know, have cultural context and all these mm-hmm. fun, twisted questions that are fun to get into. So here, for this next part of the podcast, we are going to read aloud a specific example from the paper.
In order to illustrate our somewhat abstract model of language, as well as its relationship to information theory, we now present a specific example. Let us assume that the individuals in a population all speak the same language. In this section, we will step through a complete specification of the language L, and eventually calculate FLL. Then we will reconsider the example in light of information theory in Theorem 5.1. We first stipulate that the organisms in the population are all limited, by their similar vocal and auditory organs, to the use of three phonemes. We denote these phonemes by A, M, and P. Therefore, phi equals the set A, M, P, and M equals 3. We also assume the population uses a language with word length L equals 2. Therefore, the possible words which an individual can utter are theta to the L, which is equal to a, up, ma, mp, pa, pm, and pp. Nevertheless, the population only chooses to describe three objects: father, mother, and food. Hence, the population uses a lexicon of N equals 3 proper vocabulary words. Specifically, we stipulate that this population uses the lexicon script C equals set pa ma m, which is a subset of phi to the L.
Yeah, so that's quite a bit of jargon, which essentially says that in this model, as we said earlier, we just have a theoretical language with only three phonemes and only three words. And again, if we didn't say this earlier, a phoneme is what's the official definition of a phoneme?
It's a speech sound.
Okay,
so it's not a letter, mm-hmm. but like pa, ka, da.
Yeah. So would you say it requires, I guess this is kind of a general definition, it requires a consonant and a vowel?
No. So, a vowel is a phoneme.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, cool. So it doesn't have meaning though, right?
Like, no, not in isolation.
Okay. Okay. Very good. So now that actually brings up an interesting point with the paper that was brought up earlier. According to this paper, one of the things that makes human communication, i.e. language, unique is the formation of words. Mm-hmm. And I tried to wrap my mind around that. I had a really hard time. I was like, what do you mean words? So you know, apparently there's an error limit with communication where other animals that don't have a language with words, they can only communicate so effectively. Mm-hmm. But once words are developed, then that error limit essentially goes away. And that's what this paper is trying to argue.
I believe that the intuitive way to understand that is that the more words you have, the longer the words have to be.
Okay.
But let's say there's a ball pit where with every possible word. So you'll have things like lentil soup in there, and you'll have things like in there, everything possible. Mm-hmm. There's going to be very, very few balls that are glowing because the balls that are actual words glow.
Okay. Okay. Got it.
So if there's so few words, if I say, hey, I want to eat some bread and butter sandwich, then it's most likely, I mean, bread and butter sandwich. Mm-hmm. There's an easy way to do that.
The set that you, from which you take your words or your symbols from is much larger than the set of symbols that actually mean things. And so this puts a greater distance between two words that sound alike or two symbols that sound alike. So that if you do hear an error or say an error, it can be corrected to the nearest real word. And, you know, most mm-hmm. of the time it'll be correct.
Yeah, it's almost like the glowing balls in the analogy that I have magnets on them.
Yeah.
And you try to say a word, you throw a metal ball at a close by thing, and if it doesn't strike light, then the magnets get stronger and stronger until it pulls it to that.
Wow, that was quite a visual imagery. I like that. Now, actually, this paper does try to make, I wouldn't say a pit with balls, but it does actually map out a matrix. And this is not a 3x3. This is...
It's a 3x9, and 9 is the full number of combinations of two phonemes.
Yeah, it has every possible word, including words that don't mean anything. Yeah, and that's also the other interesting thing is in this language, how this language works, as you clearly just said, certain incorrect words are very similar to actual recognized words. And that's also mm-hmm. just an aspect of this language. It's like, so all nonsense words are not created equal, which is kind of interesting, you know? Mm-hmm.
What is an n-gram?
It's like how many symbols are combined together.
Oh, okay.
So an n-gram, you could think of it like, so I had a computer science project in one of my classes in college. And what we did was it would read in, you know, you could have it read in like a book full of text. Mm-hmm. And it would, for every word, every new word that it for every new word that it found, such as the mm-hmm. or elephant, it would keep track of the number of times some other word appeared after it. Mm-hmm. So like if you had the, and this is talking, you know, let's say I took in Lord of the Rings, and ring was like 50% of the time the occurred, mm-hmm. ring came after it or something. And so you could keep track of the structure in these data tables. And then we could actually make it recreate, like stochastically, randomly recreate the author's text in, mm-hmm. in a new form. And all it would do was just say, it would put a word and then it would choose with the same kind of probability that it found in the text, the next word. Mm-hmm. So 50% of the time you would have the ring mm-hmm. and then however many, maybe the ring was followed by a period 20% of the times or something. And so you can actually have computers create new text that sounds like the author, but it's devoid of any real meaning or context. Mm.
Using Markov chains, right?
Yeah, and the principle of that is using Markov. It's a Markov chain of length 2, is that right?
I mean, for different authors, you could combine like...
That's right. You could do an n-gram of, you
3
know,
or 4.
Yeah, and it would make it sound more and more like it, but then you wouldn't come up with as creative.
And then after a while, you actually just get a copy of the book.
Exactly, because if you do an n-gram of...
5 or 20.
Then
20 is way pushing it.
Yeah, 20 is pushing it because then you only have so much source material, and so then it just starts coming up with spitting out the book for you. But if you do it of length 2, then it'll start... I did one of a C.S. Lewis book, and then what came out sounded just like C.S. Lewis, but it wasn't about anything.
Yeah.
It had phrases
it
he would say.
The same phrases, and it just duplicated his style, I guess, because it...
And it would make some syntactical sense and grammatical sense, but it very soon, it very soon fell apart.
Is there anything you'd like to plug, Tyler?
No.
And how about you?
Well, I was just thinking about efficiency with written language as opposed to spoken language.
Or sign language.
Well, and sign language. I mean, we could do that, but...
Yeah, because you can read... This is... Sorry for not answering your question, but it's interesting how you can read a lot quicker than you can hear somebody.
Can you though?
Well, no, okay, so let's, I mean,
like if I read a book versus listen to a book, I can read it a lot quicker. Conversely, I can speak a lot quicker than I can write. And it's kind of interesting. There's kind of, I wonder if the speeds of communication are equal.
See, I wonder how true that is because I listen to books at like 3.5x.
Yeah.
And that's about as fast as I read.
It depends on if you're an auditory learner.
Oh my gosh, I just thought of something. The human experience and the human significance with our consciousness might be a combination of communicating not only through verbal, but also some sign and written. Like mm-hmm. it's all together. It's all tied together.
Mm-hmm. And that...
What's up?
Umwelt.
You got it.
You know, what that sounds like to me is a multi-mode communication.
It's multimodality. Yeah, we need that. And that's the most efficient way to communicate is through, like gestures.
Monica's using her hands right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Gestures, voice, written. You know, like in the movie Arrival where they had, they had somebody perform the action, the visual, and then the written aspect of it.
And that was so you could understand something given two different modes. Yeah. But like, let's say your cable modem, you know, if you use like cable internet, it actually has different bandwidths and channels, lanes, they call them, that it's coming down through. And so that widens your communication bandwidth. And so that's kind of what I think of. Mm-hmm. You could almost be saying two things at the same time, one with your mouth, and one with your hands.
Wow.
And get twice as much information across. Yeah. I wonder if, there's a way to really do that.
I do, yeah. It depends, though. With sign language, though, if somebody were to sign to provide the visual and speak at the same time, that would not be very effective.
How do you sign sarcastically?
Can you? Like, you...
What?
You can be sarcastic in sign language.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I mean, the facial expressions are everything, you know? And you just use the same concept as you would in speech, but you would, put your eyebrows up or something.
Wow.
Because they're two separate languages, it would be rather challenging to get both at the same time. Or one, well, at least when you're doing it, you're going back to your native language, so you kind of drop your sign language. Mm-hmm. So, you would have to make sure if you're doing multimodality, all of them are equal.
Okay. So you'd have to be like those people who work at the UN.
Yeah. You have to make sure you're not dropping any of the modes.